Yes, so hi. I'm going to use initially mostly the blackboard, but the title of my talk is Neutrino Decays Over Cosmological Distances and the Case for GRBs in Special. Okay. I don't know if it's better if I pull this up first and then at the end I will bring it down.
You can put your laptop in front of this.
Yeah, but that way I can't do so.
I don't know, you can raise that hand with that.
Yeah.
So we
don't. That is a good idea.
Can you also please
change this flashlight? Yeah, there's a blackboard light right there.
Can you turn on the blackboard light?
Yeah, can you help me pull this up?
Yeah, this I tried last time. I said I'm the only person who could actually do it was Boris, I think.
Thank you. Okay, so three steps. And the first one is going to be reminding you that neutrinos actually decay. In the standard model. And the second step is going to be cosmological considerations, because I'm going to talk about neutrinos from cosmological sources. And I'm going to finish with the case for GRBs in particular. Okay, so neutrinos decay in the standard model. You didn't remember that. So probably Boris would say that neutrinos that decay are disreputable or something like that, but they are really not that much. They do decay if they have mass. We know they do. So. Let's look into a few of the decay modes. We have just to remind you, I'm not going to really base my talk on a particular model, but this is a motivation. So we have radiative decays, one photon emission, IMJ at different flavors. And of course, this is suppressed because it needs flavor changing neutral currents at free level. But if you go to the one loop level, then you can have a diagram that looks like this. Y, J, W, gamma, L, and another one that, oops, sorry, that looks like this, W, and then the loop has a charged lepton, and there's the photon. Very well. So, of course, you can change the W by Higgs, and that also works. So the thing is that this can occur. How often does it occur? Not at all. Yeah. Okay. So the decay rate, just to remind you, goes as I'm going to write it just once fully. This is the only time I'm going to do it. Sorry. Fermi. Okay, let's write it pi's. You're going to see that we need neutrinos to be massive because of this difference. There's another term that is massive here. And since they mix, we have. Let's write it like this, ML, MW, square. Okay, so because of the sum, the most important contribution comes from the tau lepton. And if we assume that these are order 1, and we assume that the masses of the neutrinos are order 1 eV, then we can calculate this and get the inverse, and the lifetime turns out to be around 10 to the 36 years, which is, of course, much bigger than about the 13.8 giga years that everything has been around.
I have a Godzilla-inspired question. I mean, I think only the mass eigenstates can decay, right? But can you really say in this case that the mass eigenstate is decaying because you have the flavor circle positions in there?
Well, we have to add it.
Those are mass eigenstates.
Yeah. Yeah, but you do have the flavor circle position in the. I mean, you have to couple essentially to the lepton, right?
You mean this, the mixing comes.
So the mixing, this is why I mean you could also claim that it's the flavor eigenstate.
No. So yeah, of course, only the mass eigenstates can decay.
Kinematic, that's what to do. Yeah.
I mean, it's the only ones that make sense that decay.
Yeah, so when is that U and U
there? No. Those factors of U occur at the vertices between a mass eigenstate neutrino and a mass eigenstate charged lepton.
Yeah. So okay, we want to make this is a new E. Then, of course, I was going to mix it again. I didn't write anything. Okay, yeah. All right.
It's okay, a stupid experimentalist question.
There's never a stupid question.
So, I mean, there must be, you know, there's the lightest, it must, some level must be mass eigenstate. The lightest mass eigenstate, it seems like by energy conservation, it can't decay.
That's the thing.
Indeed, it can't.
Right. Okay. So
no plan, nowhere to go. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So the if let's say new one is the lightest one, then new two and new three would decay eventually into new one. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
new one can decay. Yeah. Something else.
A new one could decay to something else.
Should there be something else?
But
some fermion, right?
Yes, it has to be a fermion.
Assuming that there's only three active neutrinos, nothing else, then and a new one is actually the lightest one. That's the huge assumption, but yeah, okay.
It's a harmless assumption.
All right, so that's for one photon emission. I'm not going to do in detail the case for two photon emission, but it would be something like this, of course. And this is not suppressed by the GIM mechanism, but I'm just going to put one of the, yeah. So it's given by a box diagram. This is just one of the diagrams. Okay, I'm not gonna draw all of them. And if you calculate it, because you can again change the W's by Higgs's, and you can cross the photons in the end. But if you do the whole calculation, then you get a lifetime that is about 2 × 10^57 years. Times a factor. Sorry? Times a factor that depends on the mass. Okay, we don't know the mass, so we all have to keep this as an open, as a free parameter. And if just for the sake of completeness, we could also have this case.
But I mean, that means effectively we don't need to look at the decay, right? That's the motivation.
Yeah, I'm just demotivating you to motivate you again. You could have this case, and if you have a right-handed Majorana mass term, then you're able to write this. Okay, and for this particular process, well, you can have two possibilities. For instance, nu mu going into nu e bar, or nu tau going.
We cannot agree that we have to be mass eigenstates.
That is true. That is true. Yeah. These should be.
But this is a historic confusion in the literature, in a sense, right? I mean, the people are all...
Well, because
yeah, okay, we are at the, you know, like in 2000, yeah. I mean, like
let's go back 15 years.
Maybe we should be able to do this. Yeah.
I'll just write the lifetimes for these two particular processes, but bear in mind that the ones that decay are the mass eigenstates, okay? Yeah.
How do you get the flavor changing vortex?
Exactly, that's the point, that you cannot actually
You can if you are.
If you is unitary, you can.
I'm assuming that I'm adding a right-handed mass term for the neutrino. So that's the thing. Otherwise, you can't really write this.
Yeah. Exactly.
C coupling is always split with us.
Yes.
If that's a standard Model Z, it doesn't turn one mass eigenstate into another.
Exactly.
Or one flavor into another.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So if this
it's
is.
Assuming that U is not unitary, but then it's not.
It's not a standard model. No, if it is a standard model with type 1 seesaw.
Yeah.
There is a tiny admixture.
Yes, that's the U is not unitary.
That's a non-unitary.
Okay.
That's related to the non-unitary.
Yeah. Okay. Let me just finish this bit. Okay. All right. Okay. Yes, this won't really be relevant for what it's coming later on, okay? So I just wanted to remind you that these things can decay within the standard model. And let me just, this should be about greater than 10 to 55 years. And please back to here. For either of these. All right, so neutrinos can decay, but they won't we won't really see them in the standard model. So let's go. We should go beyond, and there are many different ways in which we could do that. However, I won't go into that because what was really our intention with this work was to explore the cosmological effects on the neutrino decays. Okay, so I'm going to go into. I'm going to assume that there's a mechanism that is enhancing the decay. I mean, making them more decay rate higher, and I'm gonna just focus on how the treatment of cosmological neutrinos should go.
Who is we? Who are your colleagues?
Who are we? Walter is one of them, and another one is Philip Berwald, who is also an ex-student of Walter.
But in fact, I mean, the mechanism is invented, I think, by Tom some years ago.
That is true, in a different context.
I know you already studied neutrino oscillations about cosmological distances many years ago. And there you could see that because it's a kind of a prejudice that you know, like you could go to longer and longer distances and you would get better sensitivity, that there's a limit. And you have to think about what the clock actually is for the neutrinos. That was the
question.
Yeah. So.
I think it's one of your papers, which is like 20 years ago or so.
I'm trying to remember, but it sounds vaguely familiar.
He knows where you can study this if you would care to read more papers.
All right, so yeah, it's what Walter said. One usually assumes that given a far enough away source, neutrinos will have completely decayed by the time they get to us. Okay, and let me just introduce what we're going to call lifetime. Let me use quotation marks. Because you want to see what? Oh, sorry. I'm going to call it kappa. This is going to be in units of seconds per electron volts. And it's going to be tau, the actual lifetime, divided by the mass. Okay, and if I plug in units, it turns out to be around. Okay, and we're going to see where this definition comes from, what it makes sense. So
that theoretically motivated only.
Yeah, it's going to come. It's going to come later on. Yeah, we're just going to write it here because this just saying that we can probe large lifetimes either by looking at very long baselines or very low energies. However, very long baselines imply very low fluxes. Very low energies imply very low cross sections. So there, those are the two ways. And we will focus on ultra high energy neutrinos from gamma ray bursts. So we're going to go the way of using high L. And we will find actually that, and in contrast to what is popularly believed, using a very high L is not enough to ensure that all of the neutrinos emitted by a source will have decayed by the time that we receive them. It's actually going to turn out to be an energy dependent problem at the end, not a length dependent problem. Okay, and to do that, let's go back to the very basics and write a decay equation for the mass eigenstate I with a decay rate. Okay, everybody can solve this, it's an exponential. Let me write a decay rate explicitly. This is just the mass divided by the lifetime in its own frame. The energy, and this is where this kappa comes in. So the inverse kappa here is going to be the life, has the right units. Very well. So the key here.
Add that E over M is just the Lorentz boost.
Sure. The E over M is the Lorentz boost for this neutrino. So there's two ways of solving this. The first one is the regular one. You get the decay damping, and that comes in by assuming that this decay rate is really energy time independent, or redshift independent in our case. However, we're going to treat neutrinos coming from very high redshift sources, GRBs, AGN, that kind of source. So the right way to go is to actually introduce the redshift dependence in this equation and then solve it, and not the other way around. And so there are two considerations that we have to take into account. The first one is that the energy at production epoch is higher by a factor of 1 plus E than the energy that we observe at Earth. And the second one is what is this T, really? So this, the connection between T and L. Since these are ultra-relativistic neutrinos, you can write that the time, the propagation time and the propagation distance are more or less the same. But this, of course, is a function of the redshift of the source, of the emitter. And this is cosmology, and in cosmology there are different distance measures. You have luminosity distance, angular distance, look-back distance, or light travel distance, and this latter one is the one that we care for in this particular scenario. So what we want is something that connects, it's a distance measure that connects, that actually is giving us the length that the neutrino has traveled since it was emitted. And the one that does that is the so-called look-back distance, which is basically the distance traveled by a photon that is emitted by a source at the redshift C. And the relevant thing about the look-back distance is that it is bounded by the Hubble length. Let me quickly sketch how it goes. This is L of distance. Do a quick sketch. This is one. This is 10 to the minus 3 again. 10 to the 5. This is gigaparsecs. And let me draw this line. This line is the Hubble length, so the size of the observable universe. This is about 3.9 gigaparsecs. Nothing can travel more than that if it starts at one extreme and gets to us. So the loopback distance looks something like this. All right, this is bounded. It's asymptotically tending towards the Hubble length. And at about 1, it's already more or less reached the asymptote. Whereas if you used another very commonly used distance in cosmology called the luminosity distance, you would not be bounded. You would just grow with redshift. So this is the one that we're going to use. It has a definition, of course. For sake of completeness, I'm going to include this here. This here, hz, is just the Hubble parameter at redshift z divided by the local one. We assume a lambda CDM universe with 27% of matter, 73 percent of dark energy. And we will do all of our calculations in that cosmology. Very well, so we plug these and these redshift dependencies on the basic decay equation, and then we'll find how the decay works with redshift. And what is going to happen is that the decay will affect the mixing probability. So at this point, since we already know that neutrinos are decohered, I mean, they no longer oscillate, we can write this simply as a sum over the square of the components of the DMNS matrix, but there will be an extra term for the decay. And that will be just the number of neutrinos that remain having been emitted at a redshift of z and having been observed with an energy E0 at the Earth over the initial number of neutrinos. And this factor here, let's call it I can state, is what's going to be coming out of solving this equation. Okay? You can solve it, it's quite easy, and it turns out to be something very simple. It's A plus B, is it? And this is to the power of minus kappa I L H over E C. A, B, C are constants that only depend on the cosmology that we have chosen. This is 1.71 approximately. This is 1 minus this, and this has a value of 1.27. Okay, so I'm about to finish with the math. What is important here is that this term, let's call it Z of Z, on account of the distance that we have used being bounded, this term is also bounded. So at large redshifts, we will see that this tends to a constant value of A. So that means that even if we choose a very far away source, this bit here, the italic Z, can only be as high as A, since this is a negative quantity. All right, so that's saying that only by using very far away sources, the completeness of the decay is not automatically achieved. So what is going to be what matters for this is instead the exponent. And that means that we need this condition to be satisfied. And this translates in the energy being much less than about 4 times 10 to the 5 TeV divided by the lifetime. Seconds. Sorry. Seconds per electron volt. All right. This is what I wanted to get at. So decay will be important when that happens. That is saying that we need low energies, which is something that we saw early on. And that is also saying that our neutrino fluxes from GRBs, AGN, or whatever object that we are using as cosmological object will only be affected at the low energy end of the flux. All right, now I'm going to show you our results. But before that, just a quick word on the current bounds on the lifetimes, this kappa. There are direct appearance experiments, and that from that you can find bounds on kappa 1, 2, and 3 for different mass eigenstates. From the observation of the electron neutrinos from supernova 1987A, and assuming that these are mostly nu 1, we can put the bound on nu 1. So we saw those neutrinos were electron neutrinos. And since we saw them, we can say that the first mass eigenstate has to have a lifetime that is larger than about 10 to the 5 second per electron volt. Okay, from solar neutrinos, we can say that they have to live longer than 10 to the minus 4 second per electron volt. And from atmospheric and long baseline data, the bound is really weak. We can only say that they have to live longer than 10 to the minus 10 second per electron volt. If we had used, yep.
I'm a little bit surprised by the limit you attributed to the sun, because those neutrinos take about 8 minutes to get here, and they arrive. So don't we know that they live at least that long?
Something could happen in the end, from then to here. So that's the thing.
The gamma factor.
Yeah. It's just the gamma factor. Yes.
Okay.
Yep. Thank you.
So these limits have been recently updated by Danny and Anders and collaborators, right? We're writing a paper about this here.
Yeah.
The gamma factor that
I can remember the change. I think it's not that big. I think they use the PEP meters.
It's a factor of 10 to the 10. It's a factor of 10 to the
7.
7, all right, 10 to the 7. Yeah.
Okay.
Can you get anything from the ice cube neutrinos or something that are extra galactic?
We are working on that, and apparently the bounds are very weak. They're not comparable to this. And the thing is that the energies are too high. That's still too high. Yeah, you would need supernova neutrinos really to make something better than this.
What about supernova 1987A?
That's actually what you got, where you got this. So if we see another supernova,
So what is implying that the L over E by supernova neutrinos is much, much better.
Exactly.
And because L is constrained, you cannot use these high energy neutrinos in ice cube to actually get better, I think.
All right. And with that, I'm going to move to the GRBs. Okay, well, so I think Spencer already showed a plot like this. GRB is basically, for us, a jet of plasma blobs relativistically expanding outwards from a central emitter, which might be a hypernova. And the plasma blobs have different velocities. Eventually, they collide with one another. Particles get accelerated in the process. Some of the kinetic energy of the initial plasma blobs will get converted into particles. Protons, photons, neutrinos that get radiated away, like this, right? And we are going to work on what is called the internal shock model. So the radiation we'll be looking at is coming exactly from these internal collisions, not from the collisions of the plasma blobs into the interstellar medium. And to do that, we used a state-of-the-art numerical prediction. Again, Spencer mentioned earlier that it's called New Cosma, developed by Walter and by the group. And it takes into account not only neutrinos coming from the decay of pions, but also kaons and other higher resonances, not only the delta resonance from P gamma interactions. That said, these are neutrinos coming only from proton photon interactions, not PP interactions. But since a GRB has a very high photon spectrum, then we expect that the neutrinos coming from P gamma interactions are contributing more than the ones coming from PP interactions. So that's not a bad assumption. It was. So the photon and the proton densities at the source are obtained, are normalized by looking at by using the gamma ray data of the burst. Once sees a burst, there's a certain luminosity. We can move that luminosity back into the source and calculate what the densities were, and then make the interactions to the source and get the result propagated at Earth. Very well. So that's what we did. And these plots are all assuming that nu1 is stable remember, new one has the highest, the longest lifetime, so it's not a bad assumption. We tested it. We tested these also by assuming these values instead of complete stability for new one, and it doesn't really change much. And new two and new three are unstable and decay. So these values of kappa that you see here are for new two and new three. They have equal lifetimes. This is the flux of neutrinos and plus antineutrinos at Earth multiplied by the square of the energy. And this is the standard case where no decay is allowed. Blue is for electron, orange for muon, and green for tau flavors. As you can see, flavor, the same proportion of each flavor is obtained at some of the energy regions. That's at Earth. Yeah. Now, if we allow nu2 and nu3 to decay with 100 seconds per electron volt lifetime, we start seeing effects at the lowest end of the energy range. And if you remember that relation there, and plug in 100 in the denominator, you get about 4,000 TeV, which is more or less where the dumping is starting here. If you now increase the lifetime to 1 second, then you move up to 40 EeV as the point where the effects start appearing. And if you move...
That is decaying into something that is not there.
That is assuming decay into invisible products. So what Gonchi is saying is that if a new 2 is decaying or a new 3 is decaying, it is not generating more new ones. In that respect, this is the simplest possible decay model that we could have plugged in. Finally, if we assume that the lifetime is at the current lower bound for nu2, so 10 to the minus 4 second per electron volt, then the whole range of energies is changed with respect to the all stable case. One thing that one has that's interesting about this is that you can see that the nu e flavor is only slightly affected, while the nu mu and nu tau flavors are affected very much. And this is because nu e are mostly nu ones, nu one eigenstates. And we're assuming the nu ones are stables. So if nu one are stable, then nu e is mostly stable. Whereas nu mu and nu tau don't have that much nu one contribution.
It's two-thirds and one-third.
Yeah. So nu one has about, let's say, 60% of nu, sorry, nu e has about 60% of nu e, and the rest is nu tau and nu mu.
And so what that GRP stacking searches are looking for a muon neutrino so far.
Exactly.
I mean, there's no stacking for electromagnetic cascades, or there's no energy resolution.
Yeah.
So this is the reason why no GRP neutrinos have been seen, perhaps.
I don't think so, no, but. Okay, there are several.
There was a search for cascades from GRPs.
So there are four things that one should notice. First was, as I said, the muon tracks will be suppressed. Muon tracks are generated by nu mu, so the orange curves will be suppressed with respect to the stable case. The electromagnetic cascades created by nu e won't be that much affected in comparison to the effect on the muon tracks. And then the hadronic cascades will, of course, be affected, and the neutral current cascades will be also affected. So what this is saying is that neutrino decay will leave the level of cascade events more or less unchanged, while potentially bringing down the level of cascade events quite a lot.
Track events.
And we can also play the game of looking at the flavor ratio. This is the number of, the flux of muon flavor over the flux of electron plus tau flavor, which is more or less the number of muon tracks divided by the number of cascades. Let's look into this, which corresponds to the previous figure. And as you can see, this is the red one is the case for no decay. You can see that you get pion beam means an initial flavor distribution of 1 to 0, so two mu neutrinos per each electron neutrino. And these are at Earth, okay? These are ratios with the fluxes at Earth. So as you can see, one would expect that at a certain energy range, one would see a value of this ratio that corresponds to a pion beam at the source, this little bit here. But when the decay is turned on, then this democratic distribution of flavor no longer exists except for very narrow energy values, the energy ranges. And that is true, of course, not only for standard bursts like this one, but for real bursts like this one in particular.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that. This is actually what Mina and I claim, right? I mean, that you see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very well. So this is my final plot. And what we did here was take, just a bit of history. IceCube published a couple years ago an analysis looking at individual GRBs. And they used a catalog of 117 GRBs initially with the IceCube for the configuration of the detector. They calculated the neutrino flux from each, fluence from each, and then extrapolated towards the whole population of GRBs, so from this sample. And they got a quasi-diffuse flux, which was discarded because the calculation they did was done in an analytical model distinct from this. We took the same 117 GRBs, repeated the analysis using the new Cosmos software, which is a numerical software, not an analytical calculation, but added the decays on top of that. So this curve is, again, the no decay case. And as you can see, unlike the IceCube result, we are still below the limit. That's for a mu flavor. And if we add the decays, we again see a drop of up to an order of magnitude in the number of muon neutrinos expected Earth. Whereas for electron flavor, this drop is much, much less, independently of the value of the lifetimes. So what this is saying is, again, decay can, in principle, affect, if it is there, it can affect the number of muon tracks greatly while leaving the number of cascades mostly unaffected. Now, as to the question of whether this can explain the fact that IceCube has seen more cascades than muon tracks, I don't think so at this level. The fact that IceCube saw many more cascades than muon tracks comes just from the fact that cascades can be generated by any flavor, whereas muon tracks can only be generated by muon neutrinos through charge current interactions. And that's the current explanation of that. However, that being said, of course, neutrino decay can be there, could be seen at a higher statistics level. And what this is saying is that if we want to know with confidence details about the source, we have to look not only at either cascades or muon tracks, we have to look at both and to rule out this kind of scenario. And that's it. Thanks.
So the choice of the kappa inverse there in that plot, is that consistent with the supernova limit that you had?
This is again assuming that the new one is stable,
okay,
and that the new two and new three eigenstates are decaying with this.
But for new two and new three, the supernova limit seems to me should still apply.
I mean, you
have the neutrino mix.
Yeah, but you see the new E from supernova, and then you have to choose. Or we chose that means a limit for new one.
Well, that's not entirely correct.
I agree.
The new three flavors mix. Right?
You could also put a limit on new two or new three from that. But the thing is that the content of new one in new E is larger than of new two or new
three. Yeah, but
only by a factor of two.
Yeah.
So
it's a choice.
Something that flux on certainty if you want it, right?
That's also true. That certainly the flux is big. That André de Gouveia and collaborators, when they did their latest analysis, they actually didn't only consider new one bound coming from supernova 1987A, but they considered new two and new three. So that can be done.
So So then there was this very recent paper also by Denny Hernandez and Patrick Ticolio, right?
Yeah.
Which they finished when Denny was here. Remember this discussion a couple weeks ago when they said, okay, we can only apply it to one of the mass eigenstates in principle. Could be also that the two mass eigenstates are stable, but since the uncertainties in the supernova flux are so large, we cannot really assign it to U1 or U2. I mean, it's more natural for the one maybe, but it could be also U2, which is
sure.
Stable. So it's a. And maybe U3 is unstable, or U1 and U3 are unstable. So we know that one of the mass eigenstates must have arrived, but we don't know for sure if it was U1 or U2. It cannot have been U3 because the mixing is too small.
Yeah. But it could have been either U1 or U2 or any mixture.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. That's the choice. Okay.
Usually this is IC40. Why not also the IC40 plus 59?
Actually, the limit is from 40 by 59. But what we did was just take the same configuration that iSCIP had used at that time to put the balance on the GRB neutrino flux. And if I'm correct, that only used IC40 data.
Well, I mean,
the Nature paper.
Was IC40 plus 59.
Then probably we also used 59 and I just wrote 40.
The reason is simply that all of that appeared shortly before the Nature paper, which was not realized or credited for.
Very much. Yeah, at what point we updated it and it doesn't really change it.
No, but the thing is in the quasi-diffuse flux, it does only affect the shape a little bit. It's not affecting the normalization. This is why we always plot the so-called quasi-diffuse flux, like renormalizing this 170 GRBs to a quasi-diffuse flux, because the flux level is not affected by how many pairs to use, how many ice cube 15, how much they are actually.
Because we do it and well, so we do have higher limits.
Yeah, right. No, you're not completely.
I think the ICRC, if I remember correctly.
I'm not sure. That's where it is. Okay. So, any other questions? If not, I think we have to go for cookies now anyway. It's like 5 minutes to cookies. Thank you very much again.